Well, thank you very much. Let me begin by thanking the organizers, and particularly Cole Durham, for the invitation. It's great to be here in Provo, and I have to really say thank you to the broader BYU community for your warm reception and hospitality. It's been quite remarkable. As someone who used to organize conferences, I also have to note or comment on how well-run this conference is. I've kind of marveled at the how everything appears to be running really smoothly. Perhaps that's not the way it seems behind this show, but this way it seems as a participant. So let me begin. So I'm going to be talking about Egypt and the role of religion within within the transition in Egypt. So let me begin by stating the obvious. Egypt is in transition. With the fall of Hosni Mubarak in 2010 and the subsequent elections and the transfer of power to, at least to some extent, to the Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt is clearly going through a major transition. Now, the question remains, transition to what? Where this actually goes, where this transition leads, remains to be seen. While we typically refer to this as a democratic transition, I would argue that there are actually multiple transitions going on. There are transitions in the political realm, in the economic realm, and in the cultural realm. And here I'm going to pick up on some of Jeffrey's comments about trying to clarify terms here. I'm going to be focusing my comments on the role of religion in these various transitions, particularly in the political transition and what I would argue is in the cultural transition. And to this end, I'm going to be giving particular attention to the current debates over the proper role of religion in Egyptian public life. Interestingly, although this debate about the role of religion in public life was largely absent from the protests in the Arab Spring back in 2010, and the protests were largely devoid of any calls for an Islamic state, the question of religion and government, and particularly the freedom of conscience and the rights of minorities, has become a central feature of the post-Arab Spring politics. And we can see this particularly in the Constituent Assembly that is meeting right now, drafting a new constitution for the new order. Now, it's in this context and in this debate that many in Egypt and elsewhere see religion as a threat to the democratic ideals of the revolution. In crafting this constitution, many people are fearful that a central role for Islam in public life is going to threaten the revolutionary or the democratic ideals of the revolution. I would prefer to argue a more nuanced view, and I would argue that religion and Islam in particular is not in any way an obstacle to democracy and democratic consolidation per se, but rather what is an obstacle are the exclusive political ideologies and the exclusive and the illiberal political actors that are that remain influential in Egypt. Now, we tend to ascribe this, or tend to look at these illiberal forces as predominantly what we refer to as the Salafist parties, the more kind of puritanical advocates of Islam, but the military is also a central player in this as well. And again, I would argue that these exclusive tendencies that threaten the generally democratic transition threaten to replicate the dysfunctions of the previous order and recreating what we refer to as Mubarakism or military rule in a different guise. So with that as kind of a quick overview, let me turn then to this question of democratic transition and the different aspects of democratic transition. As I noted a minute ago, I break down the transition into three different categories: the political, the economic, and the cultural. So generally, when speaking of a political transition, essentially what we're talking about is a transition from an authoritarian form of government, where the military is dominant and the secret police or the mukhabarat are a significant feature of the political life of the society, and the government in the country is run by a small few. Transition from that type of authoritarian government to a form of government defined by a greater degree of accountability of the rule of the rulers to the ruled, a greater degree of rule of law, and a greater respect for civil liberties. Free and fair elections are a necessary part of this democratic transition process, but they're not a sufficient part. And here it's helpful, I keep thinking about Jeffrey's opening comments, it's helpful to try to think about what we really mean by the good of democracy. Is it just that there are elections, or is it really this idea of constitutional government that restrains power and holds the rulers accountable? And I would argue that when we talk about the good of democracy, it's really this latter issue, this notion of a liberal constitutional governance. Okay. Now, there's also an economic transition currently underway. And in many respects, I would argue that this is the most important aspect of it, as I was discussing last night with a number of people. And it's also the one that I will be speaking about least. But when we talk about economic transition, what we're talking about is the goal to try to address many of the economic dysfunctions that characterized that are associated with authoritarian rule. And this is important in large measure because if you look at what actually drove people into the street, it wasn't necessarily a desire for political rights per se, but it was really this idea that you have a stagnant economy, a growing population, a youth that does not see a prosperous future, and it's that that economic discontent and that view that there is no future for them in the established order that really drove the discontent and drove people into the street. But again, that's the economic issue, and I'm going to kind of set that aside for the time being. The third area of transition is the cultural transition, and this is really what I want to focus on for much of my talk. Democracy is more than just a set of a new set of political structures with parties and elections and whatever. It's also, and here I'm going to echo my other the other speaker on the panel. It's also a culture. It's an ethos, if you will, and it's an ethos or a culture defined first and foremost by tolerance. It's defined by a tolerance and acceptance of competing political viewpoints and a certain degree of inclusivity of all members of a political order or all members of a national community. And here, when we talk about democratic transition, again to echo Sophia. There's the normative dimension, which is this cultural dimension, and then there's the kind of the formal dimension, which is the transition or the change of the governing structures. And as I would argue, is that when you talk about a consolidated democracy, essentially what you're talking about is transition in all of these areas. Change in political structures, but more to the point, a change in this culture, moving from a closed society or a political culture of authoritarianism, which stigmatizes dissent and persecutes opposition, to a more open and inclusive political culture that tolerates difference and alternative viewpoints, even if they're not always respected. Now, When we look at Egypt, there are any number of obstacles to this democratic transition, and this is one of the reasons why I said at the opening, Egypt is transitioning, but the question remains, to what? Some of the obstacles include 60 years of authoritarian rule. Much of it is also tied into the sectarianism that has emerged in the last 30 or 40 years. I actually talk about this a great deal in the book that David mentioned. But it's also one of the other major obstacles is the prevalence of illiberal anti-democratic uncompromising religious ideologies, particularly among the more extreme members of the Salafist groups. And here I need to throw out a proviso that I will talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, I talk about the Islamists, talk about the Salafists. One of the things that's really interesting about Egypt is just the diversity of political viewpoints that have emerged in the last 2 years, both in the secular community as well as in the Islamic community. And again, I'll talk more about this in a minute. But these are some of the major obstacles, the authoritarian tendencies, the continued existence of political actors with vested interests in the previous order, and there are any number of hurdles that stand in the way of a genuinely democratic transition in these various areas. Lest we become too pessimistic, let me quickly throw out some of the reasons I see for optimism. One of the reasons why I still remain somewhat optimistic in the long term for Egypt is the non-ideological nature of the protest movements, the historical legacy of religious tolerance that's characterized Egyptian society, and in many respects, the pragmatic requirements of governing a diverse society. And again, these are all elements of the society that are going to limit the broad appeal of an authoritarian tendency. The point, though, remains that what we see emerging in this kind of post-revolutionary period or the post-Mubarak period is a tension between these kind of competing visions of the future of Egypt, between kind of a perpetuation of some type of authoritarian, mindset, whether it's explicitly religious or secular, and an alternative mindset or an alternative culture which is generally open and inclusive and tolerant of diversity. And this tension between these, what I refer to as an open and a closed vision of society, characterizes the ideological debates that inform contemporary Egypt. Now, when we talk about the ideological debate and we talk about how this manifests in a particular context, the key issue or the key question is whether or not Egypt ought to have a religious or a civil state. And by the term civil, I'm referring to a secular state, right? This is not a new question. It was a question that was prevalent in the 1920s and 1930s. It was hashed out again in the 1950s and the 1960s during the early Nasser's period. It was resurrected again in the 1990s and was very pronounced in the late 90s and early 2000s. It's a question that never is fully put to rest. Now, at one level, the debate is, in essence, about the proper role of religion in public life, and whether or not the religious beliefs of the dominant community ought to be given preference within the institutions of the nation and state. Should religion be institutionalized in the institution of the nation and state, or should the state remain neutral in regard to matters of religion and belief? Should the state be religious or should it be secular? Now, I should qualify this. Again, in Egypt, the debate is typically between a religious state and a civil state. And there's a conscious effort not to use the term secular in large measure because it's equated either with Western colonial rule or it's equated with atheism. And so the debate, even though what we mean by secularism, or let me phrase this, if what we mean by secularism is non-discrimination in matters of religion and belief, then the term that is used in the context of Egypt is civil. But I will tend to use them interchangeably, and we can talk about this question of secular state a little bit later if anyone's interested. So one level, the debate is over this question of religion and public life. At another level, the question is, or the debate is essentially about an issue of identity. Who is an Egyptian? Does one have to be Muslim to be Egyptian? Does one need to be Sunni Muslim to be Egyptian? What of the Shia? What of the Coptic Christians? What of the Baha'is? More to the point, should civil status, should one's civil rights and duties be tied to their religious identity? Right? These are some of the issues that Professor Ferrari was talking about last night, and this is central, an implicit part of the larger debate in Egypt. The third point about this of this debate, and this is in some respects the most problematic issue, is should the state be enforcing religious orthodoxy? I.e., is it the proper role of the state to promote a particular vision of religion in society, and ought it use the coercive apparatus of the state to punish heresy and regulate belief? This is a huge issue. Interestingly, it's one that the Mubarak regime ceded many, many, many years ago and was actively involved in regulating religion. And we could, again, I talk about this in the book, and if anyone wants to pick this up later, we can talk about that. Now, let me turn for a minute to the Arab Spring and its aftermath. These ideological debates were interestingly not part of the debate. Were not part of the protest movements in the spring of 2010 and the uprisings. Rather, what defined the protest was a high degree of unity, and this was particularly striking because it was a high degree of unity in the midst of diversity. I mean, who are out in the streets in Tahrir and Iskandria and many other places around the country? It was cops and it was Muslims. It was men and it was women. It was young and it was old. It was urban. It was rural. It was upper class. It was lower class. It was everybody. It was a very, 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 very diverse population, all of which were able to unite around a very simple message. Mubarak must go. And again, it's the economic component of it's very interesting because what had really changed was this idea that the economic dysfunction of the society was very much tied up with authoritarian rule, and it became embodied in the person of Hosni Mubarak, but also his family, and so they became the objects of opposition. Now, the unity, this really stark unity that gave so many people a moment of hope, ultimately broke down, and this should not be surprising. Because within any democratic transition, as Adam Przeworski in his famous book, Democracy in the Market, discusses, there are two stages to the democratization process. The first stage is the extraction from authoritarian rule, bringing down the old order. And the second issue, or the second phase, is the institution of a new democratic order. While the various members of civil society can unite in the first stage, and in some respects have to if they're to succeed, in stage two they're pit against one another as they realize that their common interest in getting rid of the old order is now replaced with competing interest over how to restructure the new order, and perhaps more importantly, competing visions of what this new order ought to look like. Now in the 2011 and 2012 elections, first for parliament and later for the presidency, these ideological debates were not that significant. I mean, more so in the presidential election than in the parliamentary. But I would argue that these ideological debates about the proper role of religion in public life were really kind of marginal concerns. And you know, people were not, when they voted for the Muslim Brotherhood, they weren't necessarily voting for a more Islamic state. Essentially what they were voting for was something new. It was a kind of a, to use the colloquial phrase in America, it was a throw the bums out mentality. And since the Muslim Brotherhood was not the Mubarak regime, they benefited disproportionately. In Parliament, they won 47% of the seats. The Salafist parties, the Noor Party, and some of the other smaller religious parties won 23%. And of course, the Muslim Brotherhood won the president, or the FJP, the Muslim Party started by the Muslim Brotherhood, won the presidency. Now, again, many supported the Brotherhood and the Islamist forces largely because they weren't the other side. But there are other strengths that the Islamist parties had that that the secular parties did not. On the one hand, particularly the Brotherhood, but also the various Salafist parties, had an enormous grassroots network. They had an incredible organization derived from many, many, many years, many, many decades of working at the grassroots level, you know, throughout the country in every village and every municipality. They had an organization. There was an enormous amount of money that both the Brotherhood and the Salafi parties had access to, much of which came in from the Persian Gulf. And this, we can talk about why this is the case, but in many respects, the assumption was at the time that these forces are going to be more sensitive to the interests of the Gulf and less inclined to return Egypt to the era of Nasserism. The third reason why they were so effective is they had an enormous amount of legitimacy. Part of it is, you know, just the use of the vernacular of Islam resonates with the population. Part of it has to do with and their sincerity in their use of that vernacular. But part of it also has to do with the history of repression. That the Brotherhood has a very high esteem in, you know, within the Egyptian population, you know, because of what they've suffered for so many years under not just Mubarak but Sadat and Nasser. So if these are the reasons why the Muslim Brotherhood did so well, why did the secular parties do so well? Well, pretty much the opposite. No organization, particularly at the grassroots level, very little money, deep division, and suffering a great deal from their own repression during the Mubarak era. Okay, so if these debates were not significant, you know, in the presidential elections, in the parliamentary elections, in the protests, why are we talking about them? Well, these ideological debates have become enormously significant in the constituent assembly that is now drafting the new constitution for Egypt. because the Islamist forces did so well in the parliamentary elections in 2011, they are disproportionately well represented within the Constituent Assembly. And these various forces have used this opportunity or their role within the Constituent Assembly to promote a vision of religion in society, or to promote their particular vision of religion and society. And it's this vision of society that gives the liberal and secular forces the fear that the secular or that the democratic ideals are being betrayed. Now, let me digress for 2 seconds and make an argument or try to explain the Salafist perspective. Because the Salafis do not see this as a betrayal of democracy, or do not see a central role for religion in public life as a betrayal of democracy. On the contrary, they see it as an affirmation of it. Because the way they're approaching the issue of democracy is that the democracy is the will of the majority. And they're trying to reaffirm what they see as the religious identity of the society, and they won the election, so they have the right to rewrite the rules to suit their interest. The challenge is this goes back to the notion of illiberal democracy that we were just talking about. It doesn't really reflect the constitutional principles or the constitutional democracy or the principles of constitutional democracy that I would argue are more central to a consolidated democracy. When you talk about the will of the majority, you're also talking about the danger of persecution of individuals and minority rights. And this is really where the rub comes in, where the effort of the Salafis to promote their vision of society comes at the expense of women and Coptic Christians and other individuals within society. Now, interestingly, before I talk about a little bit about some of the points of contestation in the Constitution, one of the things that I've found fascinating, mildly disturbing. Is the idea that some of the basic principles of a more overt role of Islam in public life have come to be widely accepted within the legal community in Egypt over the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. And this is rooted in an idea that for many, many well-established legal scholars and judges, there is a belief that national unity requires a high degree of religious uniformity. And so there's been a tendency throughout the Mubarak period to take a more active role in regulating religious thought. And again, I talk more about this in the book. But in many respects, the Salafis and the Brotherhood are kind of building upon this tendency and gaining some steam from it. Now, I have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to kind of skip through some of the discussion of the major elements of the Constitution. But let me just touch on two or three. One is Article 2 of the Constitution, which identifies Islam as the official religion of the state and, quote, the principles of Islamic law or Sharia as the primary source of all legislation. This is from the 1971 Constitution. It's been reaffirmed. There are debates about whether it should be strengthened. Should we throw out the idea of principles and just say Sharia will be the primary law of the land? Or should it be weakened, which is what many of the liberal and secular parties have advocated. There's a proposal to create a constitutional provision outlawing or criminalizing blasphemy. There are laws on the books against blasphemy, but this would institutionalize it or codify it within the Constitution. And this raises any number of issues, not least of which for minority populations who don't buy into the particular interpretation of religion, which is being advocated by the Salafist, but also ties into issues of freedom of conscience. And that's really kind of what this conference is all about. There's some other issues regarding an issue called HISPA and whether or not individuals can bring so-called HISPA cases against other individuals within society. And this was a major source of dispute or contention in the 1990s, where individual lawyers would bring charges against academics and scholars and whatnot, and basically argue that these individuals were apostates or heretics based upon their writing. And there's a question about whether or not that ought to be permissible. There are other issues about freedom of the press, independence of the judiciary, women's rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go on about it. But all of these issues come back to the fundamental point of how active should the state be in regulating and enforcing and promoting a particular interpretation of religion in Egyptian public life. Okay. Let me conclude then with just two or three quick points. I am skipping over a great deal here. 25 minutes does not do the past 2 years of Egypt justice, but I am kind of hitting on what I see as the key points for the issues that this conference is trying to address. What then can be generalized from this case, particularly in regard to the role of religion in democratic transitions? And I would argue that the short answer is it depends upon which interpretations of religion one is speaking of. While the tendency, and here I would like again pick up on Jeffrey Haynes' point that all religions are multivocal, and if we look at what's happening in Egypt today and we characterize it as secular versus religious, that's really missing the point. Really, what's going on is you have a very vibrant debate within the Islamic community over how to interpret their tradition for a contemporary period, or I should say for this new post-revolutionary period. And you've got, you know, the centrist modernist on the one hand, you have the kind of more traditional Azharites on the other hand, you've got the Muslim Brotherhood, you've got the whole slew of Salafist parties which are all fracturing. You have any number of perspectives, and they're all trying to reinterpret, you know, they're a tradition for a modern setting. So, and this ties into the second point, that what I found really interesting are really these internal debates within the Islamist movement itself. And what you saw in the immediate, or what you've seen in the last 2 years, is a fracturing of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it's divided between, you know, generations, between a younger generation and older generation. But there's also ideological divisions. And one of the most interesting characters, or two of the most interesting in my mind, is an individual named Abdelmenem Abou Fatou, who ran for president and did exceedingly well. And he was a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood who split with them over precisely these issues. There's also the Wasat Party and others. I won't labor them, but again, you find surprising support for a civil state among various factions of this the Islamist movement and among these different Islamic actors. The one last one I'll mention is the Sheikh of Al-Azhar, who's the head of the mosque university complex of Al-Azhar, one of the centers of Sunni teaching. And a leading cleric in Egypt, and he organized a series of meetings to talk about precisely these issues. And the statement they issued last June was a firm validation for a civil state, one defined by constitutional governments, a restraint on power, and freedom of conscience. And I would just add that one of the reasons why I think what's motivating him is a recognition of the kind of politicization of religion that we saw throughout the Sadat, actually throughout the Nasser Sadat and Mubarak era. And so there's a movement within the Islamics, you know, among the Islamic scholars, who recognize the necessity of of some distance between religion and politics for the sake of religion. So let me close then and say that religion can play a positive or negative role within these processes. The key issue is which interpretation are we talking about, and what kind of vision of social life does that interpretation of religion hold? How this plays out in Egypt, as I noted at the outset, remains to be seen. All right. So I'll leave it at that, and thank you very much.